However, I'm delighted to introduce Professor Daniel Kanstrom. He's the clinical professor of law at the Boston College Law School, where he founded and directs the Immigration and Asylum Clinic, in which students represent indigent non-citizens and asylum seekers. He has extensive experience litigating immigration and asylum cases at every level of the U.S. legal system. He's also associate director of the university's Center for Human Rights and International Justice, and he directs the law school's International Human Rights Program. Professor Kanstrom writes and lectures in many venues across the world on human rights and U.S. immigration law, criminal law, European citizenship, and asylum law. He earned his B.A. at SUNY Binghamton, his J.D. at Northeastern University, and his LLM at Harvard. And we're delighted to have him here today to discuss his book, Deportation Nation, Outsiders in American History, which was published by Harvard University Press this year. Thanks so much, Dan, for being here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I was instructed that I can talk for about 20 minutes, and then we'll have a lot of time, I hope, for conversation and critique and so forth. And critique and conversation is particularly important to me because this book really stakes out a particular and, I think, new vision of a subject with which I was very engaged in practice for many years before I sat down to write the book, and that's deportation. It's a struggle to answer certain things that it arose out of a labor of love. Let me begin by saying that. I mean, I spent much of the 1980s representing asylum seekers and people facing deportation, people from Central America, in particular Guatemala and El Salvador and Haiti and other places. And I came to understand the deportation system as a lawyer understands the system, which is as a kind of battlefield, a struggle over legitimacy, a place where lives went in one end and were changed at the other end in various ways. And there was a lot about that system that was problematic and challenging and often difficult. But it was not until after I had done that for a while that I was able to take a step back and ask myself a few questions, and it became a kind of deep itch that I felt a need to scratch over a long period of time. What is this system? Where did it come from? What is its true nature? What is its history? The hypothesis that I began with when I wrote the book was that there is something there. There's something unique there in answering those questions in a particularized, functional, distinct way. And what troubled me was that there were many, many histories of immigration in the United States. There are many great books about immigration, tending frequently to be rather teleological stories of struggle and overcoming struggle and sort of pretending to have a rather happy ending, either for the individual or for the society. And that is deep in the nature of this country, but there was really no history of deportation as a separate history, as a separate system. So that was my hypothesis, that there's something there and it's worth studying. And once I began to think about it that way, I was just overwhelmed by the richness of the subject and by what hasn't been written yet. So part of the agenda was to understand it for my clients and for the sake of the country and just for intellectual curiosity. And part of it was also to inspire others to think about this as a rich area of study. So I have a basic argument in the book, and it is an argument, and that's why, as I say, I welcome comments and questions and disagreements, but the meta structure of it is this. Deportation is a system. It's an enforcement system, and it implicates much more than citizenship or immigration status. It is about more than that, although formally that's what it is about. But it's really also is about more than that, and it always has been. My second argument is that it is anomalous, which is to say it is very different from other aspects of the legal system. It is very large. I'll give you some statistics in a minute, and I suspect that you'll be surprised to learn how large the system is. It is disproportionately harsh by any measure compared to any other legal system that I know about anywhere. It is racially charged. In fact, I will argue that it is inherently racially charged because of its history and because of its nature. And it is growing fast. Third proposition or set of propositions is that deportation challenges powerful societal values, and in particular it challenges two societal values that we hold very dear in this country. The first is the basic American mythology, and by mythology I mean something not pejorative but sociological, the mythology that we are a nation of immigrants, which we are. And that is our national mythology. This challenges that in important ways. And second, it challenges our belief in the rule of law, and in the rule of law as having an underpinning based on rights discourse and certain basic moral propositions. And finally, it's an embarrassingly poor substitute for a comprehensive immigration policy. And in effect, this is the immigration policy that we have now, is essentially deportation. So all of that led to a need to answer some basic questions going in. What is deportation? And as I studied it, obviously there's a short answer, which is deportation is the forced removal of a non-citizen from this country back somewhere else. But that turns out to be actually inadequately nuanced, I think. And as I thought more about it, and as I read some very interesting pieces that had been written in the early 1950s, critiques by law professors of the deportation system during the McCarthy era, I began to realize that there are really two separate forms of deportation. One, which in the book I call extended border control, is the type that most people think of. That's the proposition that once you accept the Westphalian world and you accept the idea of nation states, you accept the idea of borders, you accept the idea of some border control, you naturally accept the idea that government needs to have some mechanism to catch those people who may have evaded the border control. So that's one form of deportation, and its legitimacy strand, if you will, is essentially linked to sovereignty. If you accept the nation state, and not everybody does, I'm not sure that I do for all purposes, but I do for some, then you have to deal with this deportation system in that vein. But it turns out there's a whole other form of deportation, which is what I call post-entry social control. And this is the use of the system to deal with people who commit crimes or criticize the government or join political parties or form labor unions or do any number of things that the government deems to be antisocial. And against those people, deportation is deployed as a mechanism of social control. I think it was useful for me to disaggregate these two things, and I wasn't the first to do it as an idea, but I was, I think, the first to write a book, you know, sort of based in large measure on that proposition, that we should think about these two things differently because they raise different legitimacy, different conceptual problems. And in terms of the trends, it's useful to realize that one form, the social control form of deportation, is really rising fast and has been for about the last 12 years or so. And the other has been relatively constant, although in the last few months we've seen that form rising fast again as the administration wants to show that it's tough on this. Robert Jackson, it turns out, who was, as I'm sure most of you know, prosecutor at Nuremberg and on the Supreme Court and attorney general, I was very surprised doing the research to find that he had exactly the same thought, although as far as I know he never said it publicly, but when I was doing research in the Columbia Oral History Archives, I found an interview with Robert Jackson in which he said this very thing, that if people have committed acts for which they should be punished, we should punish them. But deportation for conduct occurring in the country after the alien is lawfully admitted, he said, is a very dubious policy. And I would second that for a variety of reasons that I'd like to talk more with you about. So then the question is, how do you study deportation? How do you measure it? How do you understand it? First of all, I want to make clear that deportation applies to anybody who is not a citizen. You could have entered yesterday, be subject to deportation. You could have entered 50 years ago with a green card, have family, children, whatever. You're still subject to the same system. That's the system that governs non-citizens. And of course, language here is important. Some people use the word illegal alien to describe certain things. I really don't like that term. I think it's pejorative in a couple of ways. Alien has connotations in the English language that certain other words don't have in other languages. And illegal, as applied to a person, is, I think, particularly problematic because it implies that the person carries the illegality within them, whatever they do, rather than saying that a person has committed an illegal act. Deportation takes this notion of illegality and puts it in the person. So I've challenged my students to come up with other phrases, and we've settled on the phrase the documentarily challenged. Offers you as a possible substitute. You can use it if you wish. The system can be incredibly harsh. I mean, I often tell stories of clients, and one in particular that I tell in the book was of a young woman who we encountered. Her name was Edna. She was 22 years old when we encountered her. She'd come into the United States when she was 2 years old. And she had gotten into some trouble for shoplifting and possession of pepper spray, very minor criminal offenses that resulted in nothing other than needing to check in with a probation officer. She did that for a few years, and then one day she went to immigration to check in, and suddenly, without warning, they arrested her. And they said, "We're putting you in detention, and you're going to be deported." This was post-September 11th when they started cracking down on a lot of these kinds of things. Well, this was particularly troubling for her because she had walked in with her 8-day-old baby, who she was nursing. They said, that doesn't matter. They had to call somebody from the family to take the baby. They shipped her off to a detention facility far away from Boston and told her that her next hearing date was going to be 15 months away, and she was going to be detained mandatorily with no right of bail for however long the deportation proceedings lasted, and in fact that she basically had no defenses to deportation, all of which was essentially true, and all of which... It happens tens of thousands of times each year in this country. These kinds of things, shoplifting, pepper spray, simple assault, possession of small amounts of drugs. We managed to get her out for technical reasons that I can describe to you after a few weeks, but that is unusual, and managed to get a quicker hearing. The system applies to people like that. It applies to refugees. It applies to Cambodians in particular with incredible harshness. We've seen a lot of cases of mothers who brought babies here through the killing fields in their arms, and these babies grow up in Lowell or in Seattle. They get into some trouble in the criminal justice system, and thousands of them are now being sent back to a country where they know nobody. And it's quite a harsh system, again, for minor crimes. In Massachusetts, we saw this raid over the summer in New Bedford, where they surrounded this factory. I'm sure you know about this. In New Haven, there were raids recently. They have names for these raids. The one in Massachusetts, I don't know if you know this, was called Operation United Front. I mean, I think there's got to be a special place where they train these people to come up with these names. There was one in the South Border region where they were going after people with drunk driving convictions. I'm not sure why. It seemed to be mostly Mexican grandfathers, and they rounded up a lot of people and deported them. They called that Operation Last Call. In any case, so it's a big system. It's a harsh system. I'll tell you more in a minute about how it actually works. But it's a dilemma because the United States is a nation of immigrants, and about 1 million people immigrate here every year, and over 600,000 naturalize every year and become citizens. So we have both of these things going on simultaneously in the country. Although you should know that naturalization denial rates spiked for a period. In fact, during the period 1999 to 2005, more than one-third of naturalization cases were denied. And I get calls even now. I just answered a call this morning from a guy who's been waiting 2 years for security clearances to come through. He's an Algerian, and it's going to take more than 2 years. But the FBI is sitting on a lot of these cases. So naturalization, that's the process of becoming a citizen, is easier in this country than it is in a lot of countries, but it's not as easy as most people think. They're coming up with new tests now to make it a little harder. I just saw one from USCIS, which is the heir to INS. It's the new agency that does this. They ask questions of people that you have to answer, and this one I thought was interesting for pedagogical purposes. The question was, what does the Constitution do? And then they have a suggested answer. And here's the correct answer according to the government agency. Quote, it protects basic rights of Americans. Now, for those of us who teach human rights law, that's a very interesting proposition because if you think about what's implied by that and what they're saying to non-citizens. Anyway, how big is the deportation system? You could measure this, I think, in one of two ways. One is to ask how big is the population that is controlled by the deportation system. And the answer to that is there's about 35 million foreign-born people in this country, about 20 million of whom are non-citizens. So let's start with that number. Then you have millions of people who come in, tens of millions actually, who come in every year, as students, tourists, workers, temporary workers. So add that. Then you have about 1 million new legal immigrants coming in each year, and of course we have about 12 to 15 million documentarily challenged, and we have millions more who live here in a variety of quasi-legal statuses, people applying for asylum, refugees, and so forth, and we have their families. And there's been interesting research recently about how many mixed families there are, one citizen, one non-citizen, parent, child, etc. So by any measure, we're talking about a system that governs the lives of many tens of millions of people. That's one way to measure it. Another way to measure it is to ask how often does it happen that a person gets deported. So here's a statistic. If we had more time, I would play a game with you to poll you what you think the number is, and I bet you'll be surprised. Since 1977, here's what I can measure. The number of times an individual non-citizen has been caught somewhere on U.S. soil and ordered to leave the country through one legal mechanism or another has been more than 34 million. Now, that's a big number, and that's a lot of events. And yes, my students always say it could have been one Mexican who was deported 33,999,000 times and his brother, but I think it's pretty close to 34 million people. So it's a big system. How does it work? In the book, I sketch out three trends, and I know I'm already bumping up against my 20 minutes, but I
not at all.
Okay, good. First of all, as I said, there's been a dramatic increase in the post-entry social control form of deportation. So it's used by the government as a tool. And it's not just in the war on terror, by the way, and it's not just since September 11th. It's actually since the Oklahoma City bombings, and in some measures even a little bit before that. It's more linked to the war on crime, the war on drugs, the sort of hardening of the criminal justice system in this country. That's a big trend. Second, of course, in the post-September 11th period, we did see a very targeted use of the system by the government. They called in tens of thousands of young men, only of certain backgrounds, asked them questions like, not like, here is a question that they were asked under oath. Are you associated with anyone who is potentially dangerous to the United States? That was a question that government agents asked people to answer under oath. If you didn't answer these things, you could be placed in deportation proceedings. How many terrorists, by the way, did they catch as a result of this system and as a result of the tens of thousands of deportations? I think maybe one, and maybe one, but we can't be sure that there were any. And two more trends that are worth noting. First of all, there's been an increasing expansion of mechanisms, and forgive me, this is a little technical, but informal mechanisms that used to apply only at the border, where basically the burden is put on you to prove you can come in, and if they don't like the cut of your jib, they turn you right around. Those mechanisms are moving inside the country now. So within 100 miles of the north and south border, we now have this system called expedited removal. Very fast-track system, accomplished in a couple of days, basically no judicial review. If they don't like you, you're basically out. That is a very significant historical trend, because one of the things I talk about in the book is how in every historical period in this country, there has been a real debate, starting with Jefferson and Madison versus Adams, and then going to, you know, people criticizing the Palmer Raids in the 1920s. I have this wonderful document that was signed by Felix Frankfurter and a number of other scholars called Report Upon the Illegal Practices of the Department of Justice. This was published in 1920. And they said, you know, basically you're violating the Constitution by deporting Emma Goldman and the anarchists and all that. That's the early career of J. Edgar Hoover. We can talk more about that, too. In the 1950s, same things. The writings of Carrie McWilliams in the 40s, on and on and on. It's been an eternal struggle in this country. And now, basically, one side is definitely ascendant. And the rise of informal mechanisms is the hallmark of that. For we rule of law types, that's how you know. I mean, when government gets to do things like that with no review and no process, that tells you, you know, who's rising. And finally, there's been much increased state and local involvement. So how does it work? First of all, there is mandatory detention. For most deportation cases now, there's no bail. And for many, there's no right to bail, no possibility of bail. So if they allege that you are subject to deportation, you are basically going to be locked up. And in many cases, you're going to be locked up in a regular prison. In other cases, it's in special detention centers that they have set up just for this purpose. But in many cases, they are mixed in. If you are subject to deportation, you have no right to counsel. If you can't afford a lawyer, you won't get one. And by the way, the success rate varies tremendously between people who have lawyers and don't, but you don't get an appointed lawyer. So you'd be better off being charged with shoplifting where you do get a lawyer than being subject to deportation where you don't. You have minimal and basically no Fourth Amendment rights, which is to say government agents can break down your door, they can go into your bedroom, they can rifle through your papers, they can use that evidence in the deportation proceedings, and you really cannot suppress that in court as you could in a criminal case. Deportation laws can be retroactive. That is to say, you can be deported for something that was not a deportable offense when you did it. Let me just pause on that thought for a minute, for even quasi-rule of law buffs may be struck by that. And you may be thinking, this guy obviously hasn't read the ex post facto clause recently, but I have, and the Supreme Court has held essentially that deportation is not subject to the ex post facto clause in the Constitution. And this is because of its particular litigation history, its particular doctrinal history, which, again, I'll tell you more about in a moment. You have minimal, if any, selective prosecution rights. So if the government wants to target a particular person because he's Palestinian or because he's criticized the Bush administration or joined Greenpeace or whatever, he can't raise that as a defense, as you could in a criminal case, for example, as you could if you were driving while black, so to speak. You know, if the government targets people on account of race or religion or political opinion, normally you have what's called a selective prosecution defense. You don't have that in deportation cases. You have no jury trials, and you have basically very minimal judicial review available to you by Article III federal judges. So that's what I meant when I said it was anomalous. It's anomalous compared to other legal systems. Detention is growing fast. As we sit here today, there's about 250,000 people being detained by DHS, Department of Homeland Security, for deportation. And actually quite a lot more than that, because many people who are doing criminal sentences have detainers placed on them. So hundreds of thousands of people being detained. Families are being detained now. Children are being detained in Texas and other places for deportation. I can give you some more details about that if you like. But let me get to the other main part of the book, which was trying then, with all of this in mind, to answer the question, what really is the pedigree of this system? Where did it come from? Is it simply about sovereignty, which a lot of the people who had written in the field had tend to approach it from a sovereignty studies perspective or a citizenship studies perspective? As I traced it back, I make the argument that it's really about something more than that. It's about majoritarian control over communities. It's about this sieve function of figuring out whom would we like to get rid of and how can we get rid of them. And that takes me back to colonial systems that were called warning out in New England, where if you moved from Providence to Boston, you were basically on a kind of probation. And if they didn't like you, or you fell on hard times, or you were a single woman who had a baby, or you developed a drinking problem, or any number of things, you would go to a hearing and you would be ordered back to wherever you came from. Now, that is very functionally similar to a deportation hearing. And again, in the book I talk about it at some length. I also looked at things like the Acadian deportation, where French Canadians were ordered out by the British in the 1750s. And I began to see that this dilemma, and if you read writings of Ben Franklin about the Germans or various other things, you see that this dilemma was always there. George Washington put it very well in 1783. He said, "The bosom of America is open to receive not only the opulent and respectable stranger, but the oppressed and persecuted of all nations and religions." That's what he said. But then he said, "Whom we shall welcome if by decency and propriety of conduct, they appear to merit the enjoyment." That's the other side. So the question from a legal scholar's point of view is, well, that's fine, but who gets to decide? What's the meaning of decency and propriety? What's the mechanism for deciding merit, the enjoyment? And usually with things like that, the answer is we have the rule of law. That's what the judicial system is supposed to do. But that's not how it's worked here. And the first example of that was the Alien and Sedition Acts in the 1790s, when the president was given unfettered authority to target anybody that he didn't like and order them out of the country. And the critique of that and the debate over that was really a very interesting debate, because it's very analogous to what we're seeing today. So Jefferson, criticizing that, writes, quote, "The friendless alien has been selected as the safest subject of a first experiment, but the citizen will soon follow." And that's one argument against this sort of thing, that it tends to evolve against citizens. And if you look in each historical period, you can prove that. And David Cole has written a lot about this as well. There's another argument. Madison, I think, had a more nuanced constitutional view. He said, even if aliens are not parties to the Constitution, which is to say, even if you take a sort of Rawlsian model of what a constitution is and say it's a contract and citizenship is the indicator of that contract, even if you accept that, it doesn't mean, he said, it does not follow that the Constitution has vested in Congress an absolute power over them, end quote. Which means, in modern terms, there is such a thing as human rights. People have certain basic rights, regardless of whether they're citizens or parties to the rule of constitutional law. You saw these debates then. The system in those days was largely a local system. The Alien and Sedition Act expired after 2 years. Jefferson wins the election of 1800, largely due to getting the Irish vote, I think, in New York, and it never gets to the Supreme Court, which I discuss a bit in the book. I think it's unfortunate that the court didn't grapple with those questions in 1800 when it should have. And in effect, it doesn't get to those questions again until 100 years later. And in between, what develops is this deportation mechanism, a federal system. So the next question I had to answer was, where did the federal system come from? What were its models? And of course, one of the main models were state systems. We were just talking about this before. Massachusetts and New York had rather well-developed systems that were linked to control of the poor. They were linked to control of the mentally ill. They were linked to things that had nothing really to do with citizenship status. Again, it was this idea of who are the outcasts? Who are the people who need to be controlled? And those systems were part of the model. On the federal level, and this is where the book gets a little controversial, and I'd like to hear more discussion about it. I argue that the models were the Native American Indian removal systems. In fact, one of the first laws was called the Indian Removal Act of 1830. So that's about 50 years before the federal deportation system gets put into place in the 1880s and 1890s. And I trace this not only as a functional matter, but as a doctrinal matter, that when courts were adjudicating Native American Indian cases, they developed something called the plenary power doctrine, which was the idea that the government needs to have relatively free hand to deal with these things, that these people don't quite have rights. They're not quite part of our system. They're part of some other system. That same doctrine developed in immigration and deportation law at the same time. The two systems were seen by the judiciary as related to each other. Another model were slave laws and race-based laws of removal. Actually, the first international law of removal that I was able to find in this country after the Alien and Sedition Acts were state laws, such as one in Virginia from 1823, that said if a person of color, they use the phrase a free Negro or mulatto, free people we're talking about, free people of color, are convicted of certain crimes, first they'll be whipped, then they'll be put in prison, then they will be deported, then they'll be banished outside of the state of Virginia. That is a social control deportation law. And of course, all of this is linked to the historical punishment of banishment and transportation and the creation of Australia, which again has nothing to do with citizenship status and really has nothing to do with sovereignty. It has to do with social control. That's the sort of extended part of the argument. Finally, there are the fugitive slave laws, which are a remarkably similar federal bureaucracy that gets put into place to move people from one place to another. If a slave makes it from a slave state into a free state, and the master wants to come into the free state, he can get what amounts to a kind of deportation order, or like an extradition order, to get them sent back. And I trace out some of the similarities there. And there's colonization, which were the plans developed by many people to repatriate free slaves, or not repatriate them, but to send them to Liberia. Or Abraham Lincoln had plans in Panama and Haiti and other places. These were deportations. These are proto-deportation mechanisms. So the trick then becomes, how do you make the link? And actually, the link is rather easy. Because in the late 19th century, what starts to happen is massive numbers of Chinese laborers come to the West Coast, prompting pogroms and racist violence against them. And the political and the legal system struggles with that movement. And to make a long, long story short, it's about a 50-page story in the book, they developed this first deportation system. And I have quotations from people. Here's a quotation from Senator Morgan of Alabama. During the debates over the deportation laws, quote, I think this is a good bill, talking about the development of a deportation law that said that Chinese people who couldn't prove that they were entitled to be here, and who couldn't prove it by testimony of a white witness, that's what the law said, you had to get a white witness, are going to be deported. He says, I think this is a good bill. My doubts are all removed. As a Southern man, I could see why they did not want these Chinese. We have had troubles with a foreign race in my own state, God knows. 1892. So this case, and this is the order that leads to the case, and I am coming around the home stretch now, don't worry. They organize a test case in the late 19th century in New York. A man named Li Zhou gets arrested. He's Chinese. And he gets before a federal judge, and he's a Chinese laborer, and the judge says, I believe that he's legal. So that's what it says. This is an order, the judge's order. It says, I believe that he's legal, but the judge writes in hand, so although he has established the fact of his legality to my satisfaction, he doesn't have a white witness, therefore I'm going to order him deported. So Big firms get behind this in New York, and they challenge it. Everybody thinks it's going to be overturned. This is 25 years after the ratification of the 14th Amendment. A quarter century after the 14th Amendment, the Supreme Court has already held in the Yik Wo case in California that the city of San Francisco can't discriminate against Chinese people who own laundries against white people. If equal protection exists in this country, so everybody thinks this can't be right. And they get up to the Supreme Court and they lose. And they lose with stinging dissents from some of the justices, but essentially the court says, look, deportation, it's basically about border control. It's basically the flip side of sovereign power. The courts have nothing to say about it. And ever since then, that's the doctrinal underpinning of the system. And every time somebody, including people like me in every era, have tried to challenge this, and sometimes they've come close. In the 30s, they came close. With the Palmer Raids, they came close. Felix Frankfurter signed petitions and all these people. But the court has never been willing to sort of mainstream deportation law. So it stands outside the regular legal system, and that allows the government to do all kinds of things to people. And again, then you have this war on crime theme that begins in the 1920s, and you see articles like in the American Journal of Sociology, the article entitled Scum from the Melting Pot. And it becomes irresistible to use deportation to achieve all kinds of other goals, to get rid of the Jews, to get rid of the Italians, to get rid of whoever the criminals are in each period. And it is very linked, by the way, to the personal career of J. Edgar Hoover, who begins as a deportation agent in Pennsylvania, goes to the dock to wave goodbye to Emma Goldman at 4 a.m., all the anarchists, and then creates the FBI, which leads the charge using this system. So there's a lot to all of this. And then there's the story of Mexico, which in the book I talk a lot about, and how, this historical pattern of come and work for us, and then when we're done with you or we don't need you anymore, we'll use deportation as the mechanism of labor control, exactly what's going on now, although it's remarkable. In the 30s, 1 million Mexicans get deported during the Depression, and again, Carrie McWilliams writes very stunning work about this. In the 50s, there's something called Operation Wetback, where during the Eisenhower administration, they round up 1 million Mexicans and send them all back. In 1954, the INS reports to the Congress, good news, the wetback problem is solved. There's no more trouble of Mexican labor in America. 1954. So here we are again. As I say, deportation law is the policy that we have instead of a comprehensive immigration policy. I end with a thought from Justice Murphy, concurring in the Harry Bridges case, which is another big part of this story, as one administration after another tried to get rid of him, an Australian labor organizer who's quite well known in some circles. Murphy said, quote, only by zealously guarding the rights of the most humble, the most unorthodox, and the most despised among us can freedom flourish and endure in our land, end quote. And that is really the sentiment that motivated me to write the book. I tried to distance myself from it and write a book that's academically credible and objective about these things, but I have to confess to you that it was motivated by a particular view of what rights ought to be about and what the system really means and what it stands for now. And what I was trying to do was to provide a more nuanced way to critique and understand that system. So, thank you very much for your listening, and I hope you can talk about it.